Well, hello there, my gracious ghoulies. It's Ding Dong Darkness time, and I'm Allison Dixon. And I want to talk a little bit about this show. We've been together for just around 2 years, maybe a little bit shy of that, as of this recording. And I've done a bunch of episodes on topics ranging from the dancing plagues or strange architecture to Stephen King books and movies and cults and some amazing discussion on cinema with my friend Josh. And I can tell already you're probably going, oh my God, is she saying goodbye? No, I am not. I want to get that out of the way first. Ding Dong Darkness time is not going anywhere. However, early last year, I began to have some inklings about diving into more historical topics. In fact, apart from true crime, my love of history was one of the main drivers between starting a podcast to begin with. Now, even this show is not my first foray into podcasting. As some of you might know, I did another show several years ago called Creative Commoners with my occasional co-host here, Chris, and our friend Corey. And much like this show, it was sort of a loosely assembled idea with a common thread running through it. Like with this show, we talk about anything and everything that just kind of has a little bit of darkness, weirdness, morbidness. But over on the Creative Commoners, it was a little bit of everything, but united by a love for creativity, storytelling, artistry. And every show that we did just sort of paid homage to that. We would talk about different tropes. We would play Dungeons and Dragons. We would make up our own stories using various storytelling apps. And we had a great time for 3 years doing that. And I've had a great time for the last 2 years doing this. But when I started researching various episodes for this show under the Ding Dong Ditch label, those are the little short episodes that I do here on this channel. And for other episodes I've done here, like 10 Cities, 10 Mysteries, or 10 Countries, 10 Mysteries, I found that I absolutely loved any opportunity to dive into the past, like the deep past, anywhere from sort of the mid to late 20th century on back as far as humanity can possibly go. And although I listen to a lot of historical podcasts like Time Suck with Dan Cummins, Last Podcast on the Left, Hardcore History with Dan Carlin, and I listen to a ton of true crime, I never felt like I could do it myself. I don't know why. I didn't think that I could because I just sometimes don't feel like I'm smart enough. I never feel like I'm smart enough. There's always somebody out there who's better than I am doing something. And so I usually just let that stop me. I don't recommend that. I don't recommend looking for ways to defeat yourself before you can even get to the starting line. But I think we all do it to a certain extent. It's like, nah, I'm not qualified. But the thing is, I think what qualifies them is their desire to do the work and the fact that they do it. So it isn't like something you're born with. It isn't this, you know, you have to have this God-given talent to be able to do something. You just have to be able to be willing to learn and put in the work. And so I did that quite literally without really realizing it whenever I was just going through the motions of making episodes of Ding Dong Darkness Time and Ding Dong Ditch. And so then I began to wonder, could I possibly do a historical true crime podcast? And it would be cases that were before 1980. I set that time as sort of a line of demarcation that felt similar to what we do with antiques. And a lot of people do seem to think that it is around the 1980s going back, you know, because time continuously moves forward. You who were born in 1975 might be balking a little bit at that designation, but I'm sorry to say, folks, we are getting older every second of every day. So I have no problem calling myself a vintage model at this point. I lived 44 years to get there, but I decided, well, that would allow me the opportunity to not only study history, which is my main motivator, but I could still talk about true crime just through a cultural lens. I am not a lawyer. I am not a legal professional in any way whatsoever. I'm not a cop. I'm not a law enforcement professional. I am simply an author. I am simply an enthusiast. I am simply someone who is eager to learn and gather information and share it with my fellow people. I don't do this under the guise of being a supposed expert, but I am also willing to have guests to provide their expertise. I am willing to be given additional information and corrections by people who have been out there, and making this into sort of a communal experience. So I started a Patreon dedicated to the new show. I started a Facebook group dedicated to the new show, a community of people who are bringing their enthusiasm, their knowledge, and, you know, something that will give me a reason to head to the library and start digging through books and newspapers and records and everything to create the best story that I can, the best narrative that I can, that can make you a little smarter about something today than you were yesterday. You won't become an expert by listening to anything that I provide you in my podcasts, my books, whatever. But what I'm hoping is that I can give you a firm foothold to get you to the next step in that journey of fascination, whatever it may be, right? Enter vintage villains. Vintage villains is angled toward the study of bad guys or gals or non-binary pals, as Kenji Lopez Alt likes to say. But I don't want it to be a celebration of the bad person. I want it to be a study of the bad person and what gave rise to that bad person and that bad event, so that maybe with our additional cultural and historical understanding of this crime, of this perpetrator, that maybe we can understand today's crimes, today's perpetrators, what has led to what we are seeing unfold before our eyes today. Because I often find that whenever I am extremely confused or bewildered about something that is happening in the news right now, it makes a lot more sense whenever I travel back through time to study what happened before it. I find a certain comfort in knowing that we were just as insane then as we are now in so many ways, if not worse. I need to know that because I feel like as we live in this age of information that is constantly being, you know, shoveled at us left and right, we can't really get a break from it. And here I am contributing to that onslaught of information. We can lose perspective on the people that we were before we started getting this daily deluge of info. And so I want to be able to spend time in the stacks. I want to be able to spend time in the research and looking with a very close lens at the people of yesterday, if anything, just to give proper context to the people of today. And so my show, in the broader context of the true crime community, I just want it to be the fun library, the fun nerdy circle, the place that you can come to where at least we can say these things happened a very long time ago, and maybe they can help you understand what's going on today. But at the very least, for the most part, these cases are solved, or they're so long unsolved that they're just almost like artifacts that we can study. And so Vintage Villains will be airing ideally every 2 weeks and alternating with episodes of this show once I get everything up and running the way that I want it. There will also be live YouTube recordings with guests. I already have some guested episodes already recorded, and I'm recording another one here in a few days. And all those will be accessible by the Patreon subscribers. As far as the Patreon goes, it's only $3 a month, and that gets you everything. I also have some merch out there now. So my son, Nathaniel, whom you heard not too long ago on our witchcraft episode that we released back on Halloween of last year, he designed the logo for the Vintage Villains podcast, just as he designed the logo for this show. It's a beautiful Art Nouveau inspired, old timey, true crimey, and I am absolutely in love with it. And I've put it on shirts, hats, mugs, totes, all on my Bonfire store. You will find the links to that in the show notes. There were also is merch for Ding Dong Darkness Time on that as well. I also put an infamous quote on a shirt that you might recognize if you follow this show with any regularity. And I guess that is pretty much it. I'm going to go ahead and lead you into the very first episode of Vintage Villains. It is about a lady that I have enjoyed studying for quite some time. She is a female serial killer of the Midwest from the early 1900s, 1908. And not only will you learn about her and her crimes and exploits, but you'll also get a flavor of the time period. In every episode of Vintage Villains, you will get a trip in the Zeitgeist Zeppelin. It will take you on a tour of the year that the villain either was caught, born, or where their biggest event unfolded. It depends on the story in question, but you will get a feel for what was going around in the time in which this villain thrived. So that means there will be even more historical research for your enjoyment, and hopefully things that you can pocket away in the back of your head and maybe help you win the next time you're playing trivia somewhere. So without further ado, I'm going to set you loose in the year 1908, and you'll probably hear the sound of a train rolling into the station here. Don't be afraid of the lady on board. She doesn't bite hard. This week, I took my time machine back to the year 1908, and I found a bad lady. Hop aboard and we'll go have a look-see at the original Craigslist killer, about a century before Craigslist was even a thing. We're talking about Hell's Princess, Belle Gunness, on this episode of Vintage Villains. I want to welcome all of you to the first official episode of Vintage Villains, a show that's all about true crime from the olden times. I am your host, Allison Dixon, and on my other podcast, Ding Dong Darkness Time, feel free to check that out if you like, I regularly found that I was in my happiest place when researching historical topics. For me, there is nothing more gratifying than looking back through time in order to better contextualize the puzzles of the present. So here I am bringing you something a little more specifically geared toward history and true crime. I'm looking to cover cases that take place prior to 1980. However, there are a few that might break those rules as we go along because the 80s themselves were pretty rife with a lot of villains. And I would say, as much as someone like me who lived through the 80s doesn't want to admit it, it's a pretty vintage decade by now. I'll be rolling solo most of the time, but fear not. Those of you who listen to my other show also know that I have plenty of brilliant guests in store who are happy to come on and offer their insights on various topics, and I am not going to let you down there. But one thing I want to do every week here before diving into the meat of the topic is to try and set the stage for the year in question so that we can better understand the time and the place from which our vintage villains came. It might help to make their crimes make a little more sense, but also I just love me a little trivia. So with that in mind, let's pull out some factoids about the year 1908, which is when the horrific crimes of Belle Gunness were uncovered out on that little farm of hers in LaPorte, Indiana. Now, if someone asked you to pick one of the most pivotal years in American history, you might say something like 1776, the obvious one, or 1968, where we have the moon landing, multiple assassinations, and the Vietnam War really heating up. Or perhaps 2001, though that's a year that's not quite vintage enough for this show yet. And you wouldn't be wrong about any of those, but one thing that you're going to hear a lot on this show, both here and in the future, is that things were really popping off here in the early 20th century, especially in terms of industry and innovation. And 1908 in particular was in many ways the year that brought the United States firmly into the foreground of the world. There was a sense of wonderment in the air with huge advances in transportation, communication, medicine, and manufacturing. The news was playing up the bigger, stronger, faster motif, and in some cases sacrificing the should in favor of the could in the race to display American might. And it began on the first official day of the year, in fact, in Times Square, New York City, when a 700-pound ball of dazzling electric lights was dropped for the first time at the stroke of midnight from the top of the New York Times building, the start of a custom we still observe a quarter of the way into the 21st century. I hate to even think that we are already a quarter of the way into the 21st century, but I digress. And the year would only grow more exciting from there. We have Henry Ford's Model T entering the Detroit assembly line. We have Wilbur Wright taking his longest flight yet, 2.5 hour long airplane ride, snuffing out the doubts of a world who largely still thought the Wright brothers were a pair of charlatans or madmen. At a population of about 90 million, with the highest per capita income in the world, people had access to modern marvels like electricity, gas, automobiles, and railroads. Imagine seeing all of those for the first time in your life. The things that we take probably most for granted as I speak into this microphone in front of two computer screens and an LED light and, you know, a house that is, you know, full of running water. Well, not literally, that would be bad, but you know what I mean. And the US economy was competing toe-to-toe at that time with Great Britain and Germany, and few things would demonstrate this more than the launching of the US Navy's Great White Fleet, which was a group of shiny new battleships, the likes of which were never before seen. And President Theodore Roosevelt's aim to show the world our naval capabilities perhaps gave Japan a reason to think twice about eyeballing the Philippines and other areas of the South Pacific, though we know that didn't last very long. In sports, 1908 saw the Chicago Cubs win the World Series for the first time and what would be the last time for another century plus. And in boxing, African-American Jack Johnson would travel to Australia to take on heavyweight champion of the world, Tommy Burns of Canada. After Burns refused to fight a black man, he finally succumbed to public pressure, and Johnson thoroughly cleaned his clock, going on to become the world champion for the next 7 years. But it wasn't all triumph. Violence was still very much a part of the American way of life. Despite the term melting pot becoming part of the lexicon that very year as well, it was not intended to refer to a gentle simmer. The culture was at a furious boil with anarchy and terrorism, from the Black Hand Gang setting off bombs in New York's Little Italy, and a group of angry tobacco farmers known as the Night Riders torching farms across the South. Racial harmony was still very hard to come by. Remember, we're not all that far from the Civil War, the end of the Civil War in 1865. We're still sort of in that first 50-year bubble, much like when you think of after we passed the Civil Rights Act in 1964. We're still kind of dealing with a lot of the repercussions and ramifications and resentments and everything that spilled over from that here in 2024. These fights and these conflicts take a long time to wash out of the tapestry, if they ever do at all. So 1908 was absolutely brimming with tensions in this area. And to that point, there was a riot in Springfield, Illinois, in which white citizens attempted to drive blacks from the city, and this being the hometown of Abraham Lincoln himself, no less. The following year, because of that incident, would see the creation of the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, the NAACP. But in spite of it all, 1908 seemed to be bursting at the seams with hope for immigrants and citizens alike. The idea that anyone could, in this country, come here and build a good life never seemed more prevalent than it did in those days. And it's on those coattails of hope and optimism that a young woman from Norway would ride to our shores in search of love and riches. And she would ultimately find both, but at what cost? Among the wonders, novelties, and advancements in human capability in 1908, we would soon learn of the existence of a female serial killer, and a pretty industrious one at that. So, let's get into it, shall we? In late April of 1908, authorities were summoned to a pig farm in LaPorte, Indiana, where a house was being consumed by an immense fire. From the burned debris, authorities would recover the bodies of a woman and three young children. But that was only the beginning of the horrors they would discover on that property, and a mystery that endures to this very day. The home's proprietor, Belle Gunness, would soon become known by monikers like the Lady Bluebeard and Hell's Princess. The latter is also the title of one of my main sources for this show, Hell's Princess by Harold Schechter. You'll probably be hearing his name a lot in episodes of this show because he's one of the best historical true crime authors out there, and I highly recommend you pick up some of his books. There are a few authors that can really paint a picture of the time in question like Schechter. But the story of Belle Gunness goes a little deeper than her prolific black widowing hijinks in rural Indiana. Just like many infamous serial killers whose names you could recite in your sleep, Bundy, Gacy, Dahmer, etc., Gunness turned out to be quite the cunning psychopath. And like so many inclined to homicide both before and after her, she also had a taste for insurance fraud. In fact, there wasn't much she owned or accomplished, even down to the children she raised, that wasn't the product of thievery. As you'll soon see, that greed would also be a great part of her undoing. Belle Gunness was born Brunhild Palsdatter Sorseth in Selbu, Norway on November 11th, 1859. Hashtag Team Scorpio. She was the youngest of eight children. And starting at about age 14, she took on work as a farmhand and a milkmaid, and she had a pretty imposing physical stature for any person at that time, let alone a woman. She's said to have been close to 6 feet tall and upwards of 250 pounds, and that weight was mostly muscle, so she was well suited to the type of physical labor she did throughout most of her life, not including the actual murdering, though I'm sure the physical labor involved in bludgeoning and dismembering an estimated 40 people helped keep her pretty toned as well. In 1881, she used the money she'd saved up from her years of farm work to immigrate to Chicago and join her sister Nellie, who'd come over several years previous. After her sister's horrific deeds were uncovered, Nellie would say that Belle had always been especially enamored with money. Quote, "That was her greatest weakness. As a young woman, she never seemed to care for a man for his own self, only for the money and luxury he was able to give her." Her move to the United States is also when she changed her name from Brunhild to Belle. In the Windy City, she worked as a domestic servant and then as a butcher in a meat shop until she met her first husband, Mads Sorensen, who was a local night watchman. Belle and Mads married in 1884, and things started turning kind of weird at that point. Their first house burned down, and fires are going to become a common theme in this episode. And they used the insurance payout from that fire to help finance the purchase of a small grocery store, something more akin to a bodega by the descriptions of the place. And this was in the Chicago neighborhood of Austin. But after the store proved to be unprofitable, it too would mysteriously burn down. And they would use that money from the insurance payout to buy a house a little more outside the city. And there the couple eventually settled down with four young children, but here's another mystery. No one knows precisely where these kids came from. Some accounts say they were hers by birth, but according to others, Belle claimed to be unable to conceive, and the likelihood of her having this many children in such quick succession, especially after years of trying, and in 1908 when there's no such thing as, say, in vitro fertilization or other hormonal treatments, it's kind of unlikely. There have been some unverified reports that she lost a pregnancy at the age of 18 after being sexually assaulted, and perhaps this was an attempt to explain her homicidal urges against men, but it's impossible to verify those things. The consensus, however, seems to be that she either adopted these kids as fosters or simply bought them from, you know, desperate, impoverished women who couldn't care for them, which would not have been very hard to do in a big city like Chicago in those days. However, two of those children never survived infancy. Both died within their first 6 months from colitis, which is an infection of the large intestine. And those same symptoms can also be linked with certain types of poisoning. Given what we'll cover about Belle's modus operandi in this episode, that seems both likely and probable, though it was also sadly common for children back in those days to die in infancy or early childhood from any number of diseases. So, like the acquisition of these kids, the true cause of their demise can't be answered with any certainty. That said, Belle did also receive insurance payouts for both babies' deaths. So, yeah. Given all these fires and deaths and insurance payouts, some naturally debate as to whether her husband, Mads, was in on all these scams with Belle. On the one hand, it seems hard to imagine a woman of that time pulling off such things without the knowledge of her husband, if not his direct participation. I think if Mads had been in on it, he wouldn't have been so willing to take out large insurance policies on his own life. That said, people can also have some pretty big blind spots, especially when greed and love mix together, and it's possible Mads was naive enough to think that their 15 years of marriage together carried a little more weight in the loyalty department. At any rate, under Belle's insistence that his original $2,000 policy wasn't adequate enough to provide for the family upon his death, Mads upgraded to a $3,000 policy, and that's a little over $100,000 in today's money, so not an insignificant sum. However, there was one particular day when the old insurance policy and the new one overlapped and were both active, and that was on June 30th, 1900, which also happens to be the day that Mads Sorensen died. Cue the gasping sounds. According to Belle, he came home from work complaining of a headache, and she gave him quinine powder. I guess that was a common headache remedy back in those days, and not just a key ingredient in my favorite cocktail mixer, tonic water. And she told him to go take a nap. A few hours later, she found him dead. The family physician who'd been treating Sorensen prior to his death ruled he'd had a cerebral hemorrhage, but another doctor who'd examined the body thought the symptoms looked something closer to a poisoning. He asked to see the paper the quinine powder had come in, but Belle claimed she'd already disposed of it. In any event, the family doctor's ruling ultimately had more sway, and Belle was soon $5,000 richer, again, the equivalent of roughly $150,000. Of course, the insurance company and all the nearby neighbors were suspicious of Belle by this point, particularly as she seemed to be the unluckiest woman in the world to have tragically lost two properties to fire and two infants back to back to the same mysterious cause, followed by the death of her husband. But knowing something and proving it are two different things. So Belle Gunness used her new fortune to purchase a 48-acre pig farm in LaPorte, Indiana, which is situated roughly 65 miles southeast of Chicago. People were beginning to whisper about the potential source of so much misfortune, and Belle needed a place to escape speculation, as well as set up a more private base of operations for what would become a very profitable Black Widow scheme. Belle moved with the two remaining daughters from her marriage to Mads, as well as another adopted infant daughter. Again, no clue how she's getting these kids. On April 1st, 1902, after a little bit of time mourning and getting set up on her new farm, no doubt, Belle married a widower named Peter Gunness. Peter came to this marriage with two daughters, one of whom was an infant. A mere week later, that infant would die of unknown causes under Belle's care while Peter was away from home. 8 months later, Peter himself would also suffer an untimely death. According to Belle, it was all an accident. Peter had been reaching for something on a high shelf in the kitchen when a heavy meat grinder that was on a shelf higher fell and landed on his head. This was corroborated by a large gash on the back of his head. However, the coroner also suspected Peter might have been poisoned. There was a grand jury of sorts, a coroner's jury, which sounds similar to an inquest. And that sounds like, you know, a gathering where they present evidence to decide whether there even is a crime to prosecute. But nothing came of the case, and it was officially ruled an accident. Belle was yet again awarded life insurance money, this time in the amount of $3,000. And now is when we get to talk about the personal ads that Belle placed in the newspaper, aka Old Timey Tender. After the death of Peter, Belle didn't waste much time finding another suitor with some money to burn. She began putting ads in American and Norwegian newspapers in the hopes of attracting new potential victims. In her correspondence with them, she would instruct them to cash out their assets and bring their windfalls with them in the hopes of starting a successful new life together. I want to read the ad, one of the more famous ads that Belle placed that had perhaps dozens of men desperate to take all their money and flee to Indiana to meet this rich widow. Comely widow who owns a large farm in one of the finest districts in LaPorte County, Indiana, desires to make the acquaintance of a gentleman equally well provided, with view of joining fortunes. Triflers need not apply. Triflers need not apply. Indeed. Perhaps it was that last line, like a subtle taunt, that struck at the hearts of so many lonely men who had already traveled all the way from Norway. So what was a few more states in order to find someone that they could build a life with? And here's a quote according to Harold Schechter. George Barry arrived from Illinois with $1,500 in cash. Christian Hilkfin sold his farm for $2,000 and brought it to LaPorte. Emil Tell also showed up with $2,000, while Ole Budsberg and John Moe came with $1,000 each. None of these men were ever seen again. According to Schechter, like so many psychopaths, she was very shrewd in identifying potential victims. These were lonely Norwegian bachelors, many completely cut off from their families. She beguiled them with promises of down-home Norwegian cooking and painted a very seductive portrait of the kind of life they'd enjoy. And based on what people would later discover, this was only a small sampling of the people Gunness reeled in and divested not only of their life savings, but their very lives. However, because only a relative handful of them could be successfully identified, Belle's murder count ranges anywhere from 11 to as many as 40, but I'll talk about a few more here. Wisconsin farmhand Gary Gerholt traveled to LaPorte in 1905. He wrote his family saying that he liked the farm, was in good health, and requested that they send him seed potatoes. When they failed to hear from him after that, the family contacted Gunness, and she told them Gerholt had gone off with horse traders to Chicago. She kept his trunk and fur overcoat. John Moe, meanwhile, one of the men who brought the $1,000 I mentioned a minute ago, answered Gunnis's ad in 1906. After they had corresponded for several months, Moe traveled from Minnesota to LaPorte and withdrew a large amount of cash. Although no one ever saw John Moe again, a carpenter who did occasional work for Gunnis observed that Moe's trunk remained in her house with more than a dozen others. And you're probably wondering how so many men might have fallen for such a scheme in the first place. And some might attribute it to the customs of the time. We're talking about a newspaper ad and sight unseen here. There wasn't technology. We didn't have dating apps and phones and instant access to people's entire lives at our fingertips. So people were taking a lot on faith back then. But we also have to keep in mind that a lot of this type of scamming still happens today, despite having the internet. And I think it's because the type of people with these devious minds just have the ability to manipulate people by using their desire for stability and belonging against them. It's the way cult leaders, for instance, operate. You can listen to my whole series on cults over on my show, Ding Dong Darkness Time, to get a little more understanding of how people can be coerced to act against their best interests. And I feel that that is just a plain human tendency outside of any realm of time. And we'll see this play out again and again and again on different episodes on this show, but also really take a gander at any true crime show out there for more, right? But the last known victim, Andrew Helgelein, a Norwegian immigrant and wheat farmer from South Dakota, she corresponded with him by letter for nearly 2 years, enticing him to come to her. And several of those letters survived. Per an article from the New York Post that interviewed Harold Schechter, here's how some of the conversation went down. "We shall be so happy once you get here," she wrote in one. "I place you higher in my affections than anyone on this earth." All the while, she had made two desires clear, that he should bring all his money, not leaving a cent behind, and that he should tell no one so their new life together could be a surprise for their families. Now, again, would that seem a little suspicious to you now? Absolutely. Do people still part with very large sums of money at the request of people that they are in love with? Check out the documentary Bad Boyfriends on Netflix if you want to see a modern example of how somebody could be enticed to giving up every cent they've ever earned because of someone they're in love with. And again, I think we're just looking at one of the earliest examples of that, and the fact that she's using newspaper ads in order to do it. Belle Gunnis probably would have been very happy in the year 2024 with social media. Now, during the time she was corresponding with Helgelein, Belle was entertaining other interests, both from afar and locally. The local in question was her own hired farmhand, Ray Lamphere. Now, Ray would do all sorts of odd jobs, repairs, and other gruesome chores, as we'll later find out. In the fall of 1907, the two of them struck up a love affair, and Ray was completely smitten. He would show off all the gifts around town that Belle had given him, and he was convinced the two of them would marry. The only problem was Ray was poor. And the one thing, as we learned from Belle's sister, that Belle wanted in a man was cold, hard cash. And she certainly wasn't going to bother marrying any man to get it, now that she knew she could simply bash them over the head and take the money they brought from their savings accounts. Ray was just someone with whom Belle could easily pass the time while waiting for one of her bigger fish to come in. And once she received word from Andrew Helgelein that he would be making his journey to her in December of 1907, Gunnis abruptly ended her relationship with Ray, and she relegated him from his place in her house out to one of the other buildings on the property. And well, as you can imagine, he didn't take too kindly to that. But Ray Lamphere's story ends a bit differently than these other guys, and we're going to have to circle back to him in a little bit. Now back to Andrew Helgeline. When he arrived in La Porte in January of 1908, perhaps ripe with the same aforementioned hope and optimism that was flavoring everything that year, Bell didn't dilly-dally. Even after 2 years of loving correspondence, she could not wait to hit the bank. With his $2,900 check in hand, Andrew was interested in cashing out. It took a few days, though, because the check wasn't from a local bank, but once the money came in, Bell was apparently the one who went to collect it, and she paid several bills and made deposits into two savings accounts while she was there. From this point, Andrew Helgeline was never heard from again. It's likely he was already dead by this point, or would be very soon thereafter, his ultimate purpose in Bell's plan fulfilled. But Andrew would represent a tipping point in Bell Gunness's lucrative murder streak. The last 3 or 4 years had netted her dozens of would-be suitors and a pretty sizable nest egg, but in all those years, none of her victims had family who either could or would put much effort into locating their missing loved ones. This is likely why Bell chose fellow immigrants. She understood that experience very well, and that it was largely a lonely and solitary one, because a lot of people would come to this country by themselves and then get set up here and then start sending money back home and then eventually be able to bring more family members over. But for the most part, a lot of the people that Bell took advantage of were people who were by themselves, or maybe in the case of like Andrew Helgeline, he at least had a brother. And that's who we're going to get to now, because his brother Asel was also up in South Dakota. And Asel wasn't going to take his brother's absence lightly. He'd been bewildered by Andrew's lack of contact once he left, and he became even more so when he found a stack of letters from Gunness that Andrew had left behind. In them, as we know, Bell repeatedly cajoled Andrew to gather all his money, tell no one, and join her in Indiana. And Asel immediately became convinced that his brother had been the victim of a con, and so he wrote Gunness to ask of Andrew's whereabouts. She responded, saying he'd spoke of visiting family in Norway and departed weeks previous. Asel, however, did not buy it, and he made plans to visit the Gunness farm himself. But he wouldn't arrive until May, and by that point, things had changed quite considerably. Now, let's hop back to Mr. Ray Lamphere, whom we left stewing in his britches after being tossed aside in favor of Andrew. Now a jealous and spurned lover, Lamphere was apparently making himself a bit of a nuisance around the Gunness farm. She fired him on February 3rd, 1908, and then began to complain to authorities that Lamphere wasn't in his right mind and was threatening her and her family. She even tried to have him declared insane in a public hearing and have him put away somewhere, but those efforts failed, and Ray was set free again. Meanwhile, Bell was receiving increasingly alarmed letters from Asel Helgeline, who wanted to come down to La Porte and search for his brother. And Bell would respond to these letters of his saying, "Well, that would be a big job for you to come down and search for him, and expensive. I hope that if you think I'm going to get involved, that you don't think I'm going to do it for free." So again, she's always had this financial motive to pretty much everything she did. All of her lovers were the dead U.S. presidents on the bills that she stole from her victims, I guess. So the walls were closing in. Ray Lamphere wasn't going away, and Asel Helgeline was soon going to show up and create a lot of attention on that farm for her. And it wasn't like she could get rid of Ray at this point. I mean, I had been thinking, well, why didn't she just bash him over the head like the other guys, right? But he had already brought a lot of attention to her, and his absence, either whether they found his body or he just disappeared, would probably point all the attention in her direction. So a little too late on her account. If anything, if she was going to get rid of him, she should have done it months ago. But anyway, Bell was nothing if not a woman of action. She wasn't going to just sit and wait for the walls to come crumbling down around her. Early on the morning of April 27th, she visited her attorney and drew up a will, claiming that she was afraid Lamphere was going to harm her and her daughters, and that he had threatened to burn her house down. In her will, she left her estate to her family, and then she swung by the bank and paid off her mortgage. Many would initially interpret these acts as those of a woman worried about her own life, and I guess in a way you could say she was, but not in the way that we think. It would eventually appear she might have been laying the seeds to frame Ray Lamphere for her own murder, which feels a little like Gone Girl, if you ask me. But the very next day, again, suspicious timing is ever a theme in this story, along with the fire and the insurance fraud. In the wee hours of April 28th, 1908, farmhand Joe Maxson, whom Gunnis had hired to replace Ray Lamphere, awoke to the smell of smoke. His room was on the second floor of the Gunnis house, and he'd encountered flames when he tried to exit through the door, so he ended up having to leap from the second floor window in order to escape. And he would run to town to summon help, but by the time the fire department would arrive to the property, the house would be little more than a smoldering ruin. Inside the home, authorities would find four bodies, three children still in their beds, and an adult woman who no one could identify on account of the fact that her head appeared to be missing. Strange, no? Upon further examination of the woman's body, no one could agree that it was that of Belle Gunnis. So there were a lot of people that came over to view the body to try to identify this headless woman. We have C. Christofferson, a neighboring farmer, who took one look at the charred remains and said that it was not her. And another farmer, L. Nicholson, also did the same, as did Mrs. Austin Cutler, who was an old friend of Gunnis. More of Gunnis's old friends, including Mrs. May Olander and Mr. Sigward Olson, arrived from Chicago, all of whom examined the remains of the headless woman and said it was not her. And that's because of a matter of proportions, right? Doctors would measure the remains, and they even took into account the missing height of the neck and the head. And they stated the corpse was that of a woman who stood only 5'3" and weighed no more than 150 pounds. I will say, though, the 150 pound thing could be a little iffy. I mean, if she was 250 pounds in life, give or take, I don't know how they were able to guess, because the body was pretty charred from the accounts that I've read. However, this was their estimation. It did seem to be that she was, this woman, this headless woman, was definitely more petite than Belle Gunnis was. So we have friends and neighbors, as well as the clothing sellers in LaPorte who made her dresses and other garments, and they swore that Gunnis was taller than 5'8" and weighed over 200 pounds. And so the detailed measurements of the body were compared with those on file with all of the stores where she purchased her apparel, and none of it matched. And so authorities concluded at this point that the headless woman could not possibly have been Belle Gunnis. The doctor, Dr. Myers, who examined the internal organs of the dead woman, also sent stomach contents of the victims to a pathologist in Chicago and found that the organs all contained lethal doses of strychnine. And then the county sheriff, who had heard about the threats being made by Ray Lamphere, he quickly started looking for him, thinking, you know, this had to be the guy. The fire, you know, Belle had told people she was worried that Ray was going to burn down her house, that he had threatened to do so. And then the lawyer that Belle had visited the day before came forward to recount his tale about how Gunnis had drawn up a will and feared Lamphere would kill her family and burn her house down. So this was all, you know, whether Belle was just laying the seeds or whether it was true, there was every reason in the world to go find Ray Lamphere. And then they did. And according to some accounts I've read, he was actually wearing Andrew Helgeline's overcoat. So that alone was not going to help his cause. But the sheriff confronted him. And before the sheriff could actually ask, "Do you know what happened to Belle?" Lamphere said, "Did Widow Gunnis and the kids get out all right?" And he was then told about the fire, but he denied having anything to do with it, claiming he wasn't near the farm when the blaze occurred. However, there was a young witness named John Sulliam who came forward, and he said that he had been watching the Gunness place and that he saw Lamphere running down the road from the house just before the flames erupted. And Lamphere even challenged the kid, saying, "Oh, you won't look me in the eye and say that." And of course, the kid was like, "Yeah, I will. You found me hiding behind the bushes and you told me you killed me if I didn't get out of there." And at that point, Ray was arrested. So not the brightest bulb, but certainly one who was able to somehow bring down Belle Gunness's scheme pretty handily. Whether he started the fire or not, I would say that without the actions of Ray Lamphere, Belle probably could have kept killing for quite a long time. So Belle's dentist came forward at this point to state that if anybody could find any missing teeth on the scene, that he should be able to identify them as hers. And that's because he'd apparently done a good deal of dental work on her over the years. So Joe Maxson and some other people would return to the house to begin sifting the debris for teeth. And they would eventually find some intact as part of a jawbone. And there were some bridge work on those teeth that the dentist would claim belonged to Belle. And this was enough for the coroner, who would then declare Belle dead, and that would allow Sheriff Schmutzer to charge Ray Lamphere for murder. But we're not done on that farm just yet. Remember our friend Asel Helgeline, obvious winner of that year's Best Brother of the Year award, if I do say so myself. Well, he happened to see a newspaper clipping about the fire at the Gunness farm, and he rushed to Indiana at that point, arriving in LaPorte on May 4th to find a town that was in active mourning over the loss of a good, hardworking mother and her three children. Remember, by this point, nobody knows anything that has gone down on this farm at all. As far as the rest of the town is concerned, you know, Belle Gunness was this great mother and this woman who'd endured such tragedy, and now she herself has been killed in a fire. It was just this really sad thing for everybody. So Asel spoke to the sheriff and showed him the letters between Gunness and his brother, and stated his certainty that Andrew had met his demise there. And the sheriff did allow Helgeline to visit the farm with farmhand Joe Maxson to have a look around. Asel spent a couple days there looking and, you know, digging around the house, but he turned up nothing. And he was about to give up when he asked Joe Maxson if he knew of any work that had been done in the ground around the property. Maxson said Gunness had ordered him to bring some dirt to fill in some soft depressions that had formed around the pig pen where she had allegedly buried some garbage. Helgeline wanted to start digging over there, thinking he might find something in that trash that could point him in the right direction. And, well, wouldn't you know it, they wouldn't dig for very long. In that first depression, the men quickly pulled up a gunny sack. And within that gunny sack, they would find the dismembered hands, feet, and head belonging to Andrew Helgeline. And despite the decomposition, Asel would immediately recognize his brother's face. And this is when the men would discover dozens more similar depressions in the dirt. Every shovel into that earth would reveal a new horror. Five complete bodies were recovered the first day, four the following day. One of the discovered bodies was that of Belle's oldest foster daughter, 16-year-old Jenny Olson, whom Belle claimed long ago had left home to attend school in California. There were also remains belonging to two younger children that were never identified, suggesting that Belle's tastes for murder went beyond that of lonely, hopeful men. There was no way to keep an accurate tally of how many people might have been buried on the Gunness farm, and most of those remains were impossible to identify, but of the intact bodies, they'd been dismembered into at least six pieces. The bones were crushed on the ends as if they'd been struck with hammers. The heads were covered in quicklime to aid in decomposition. Most of the skulls showed clear evidence of blunt force trauma. Testing on the bodies would also reveal the strong presence of Belle's old favorite, strychnine, leading to the conclusion that she would use the poison to incapacitate them before bludgeoning them to finish the job. Amid the gruesome burlap bags were piles of men's shoes and other discarded belongings for which Belle had no use, just tossed into the dirt like the refuse she saw their owners as. The sheer volume of unidentified remains led to the LaPorte police being inundated with inquiries about dozens of people who'd gone missing and might have crossed paths with Gunness, many of whom had spoken of going to meet a rich Indiana widow. One day, I'll have to do a whole series on something called yellow journalism. It refers to the style of reporting that was prevalent in the 19th and early 20th centuries that elevated sensationalism over facts and was the result of a feud between the two major media figures of the time, William Randolph Hearst and John Pulitzer. Yes, he of the famed Pulitzer Prize. And many of you might be thinking that such sensationalism hasn't really gone away, and you'd not be wrong. We call it tabloid journalism now, or the Daily Mail, or cable news networks. But back in those days, it was particularly rampant, with outright lies and gossip openly and wantonly reported as truth to sell as many newspapers as possible. And its implications on history were wide and deep, playing a direct role in starting the Spanish-American War, among other things. But I digress, only wanting to establish this so that when I explain how the public behaved when it learned of the horrors uncovered on the Gunness farm, it'll make a little more sense. To call this a media circus seems like a gross understatement. This was a parade of ghouls, ghoulchella, if you will. Reporters who'd initially written warmly of Gunness in the aftermath of the fire had quickly rebranded her with those nicknames like Lady Bluebeard and Hell's Princess and Indiana Ogress. And the gruesome stories in the newspapers drew upwards of 20,000 people to LaPorte in a single weekend to get a glimpse of body parts being pulled out of the ground. People also sold ice cream, cake, and souvenirs, which included pictures of the dug-up remains. In fact, the pictures of Andrew Helgeline's decomposed head were one of the biggest, quickest sellers, and you can still find these pictures out on the internet. Yes, I have seen them. No, I do not recommend you go have a look. They are made no easier to look at because they're in black and white. Trust me on this. And there were even recipes for Gunness stew circulating around, which I imagine was just regular beef stew, but I don't want to think too much about that. So, picking up back again with Ray Lamphere, he was arrested for murder and arson and would soon be on trial. Despite being found wearing Andrew Helgeline's overcoat, he denied murdering anyone or helping Belle in the commission of her murders. That said, the identity of Belle's body was still very much in question. Remember, the distinct height and weight differences and the inability for anyone to really confirm it was her. All they had was that jawbone with a few teeth in it and some melted gold dental work. You know, today we'd be able to quickly do some DNA identification on this and have a question, but obviously we're nowhere near that in 1908, despite all the other great marvels that were happening at the time. Lamphere's defense relied heavily on this problem of identification, performing its own testing on teeth and similar dental work in blacksmith forges to see how it would hold up. All the testing showed damage, of course, far greater than those items recovered from the house. In fact, the metal in the dental work showed less damage than other metals that had been found nearby. Further hurting the prosecution's case, farmhand Joe Maxson would later testify to seeing someone plant that dental evidence on the scene. The resulting verdict would see Ray Lamphere convicted of arson, but he was acquitted of murder. On November 26, 1908, he was sentenced to 20 years in prison, but he would die of tuberculosis only a year later. But what of Belle's real fate? Did she die that night? Or did she see the walls closing in and decide to fake her own death and make a smooth getaway while letting Ray Lamphere take the fall? Well, no one, not even Harold Schechter, who spent years researching Belle Gunness and this case, can say with any certainty. And that's kind of rare for him. He said of all the cases that he has studied, this is one where he thinks that either outcome is equally possible. So I'm willing to take the experts' ambivalence over that and apply it to my own feelings, though with the caveat that I could definitely see Belle Gunness having gotten away. But before Ray Lamphere died, he made a couple confessions to both a reverend and a fellow inmate. And he stated, and this is to Reverend Shell and a fellow convict, Harry Myers, that he had not murdered anyone, but that he had helped Gunness bury many of her victims. And when a victim arrived, she made him comfortable. She would cook a large meal and, you know, be very charming. And that seems to be a common thing, by the way, with Belle Gunness, is that she had a charming way about her. If you look at pictures of her, she is not this stunningly attractive woman. She looks like a woman who's worked hard her whole life on a farm. You know what I mean? She's not a glamorous person by any stretch of the imagination. And despite the money she had, she didn't appear to put a lot of it into sort of fancy things. But men were attracted to her, and she was very active, both sexually and just in general. And so, you know, she had this way of bringing men in and charming them and cooking for them. And then she would bring out the strychnine. And according to Ray, she would drug their drink. And then when the man would be knocked out, she would split his head, usually with a heavy object or an axe or a hatchet of some kind, usually. Sometimes she would simply wait for the man to go to bed and then enter the bedroom by candlelight and kill them while they were in their sleep. So it would vary. Due to her strength, again, she was a butcher. She knew how to handle, you know, large animals and dismember them. She would, you know, carry the bodies to her basement, place them on a table down there, and then cut them up into pieces. And then she would bundle those remains and bury them in the hog pen and in the various areas around on the land. And then sometimes she would dispose them in different ways. Sometimes she would dump the corpse into a scalding vat that would be used for the hogs on her farm. And Lamphere stated that if Belle was overly tired after killing one of her victims, that she would chop up the remains, and then in the middle of the night, she would just dump them into the pig pen to feed the pigs with. And Ray Lamphere also cleared up the question of the headless female corpse. According to him, Gunness had lured this woman from Chicago on the pretense of hiring her as a housekeeper. And this was days before the fire on the farm. According to Lamphere, Gunness drugged the woman and then bashed her head and decapitated the body. She took the head, tied weights to it, and dumped it in a swamp somewhere near her land. And according to him, she also chloroformed her children, smothered them to death, and dragged their bodies along with the headless corpse to the basement. She dressed the female corpse in her old clothing and removed her false teeth, placing these beside the corpse to assure it being identified as Belle Gunness. So she apparently removed her own teeth. So whether they were planted or not, there's some inconsistencies here. And of course, anybody who's spent enough time in true crime knows a lot of these sort of confessions need to be taken with a grain of salt, but it sort of rings true as well. So Lamphere claimed that he had helped her with all this, but she had not left by the road where he waited for her after the fire had been set. She betrayed him in the end, cut across the open fields, and then disappeared into the woods. Some accounts state that Lamphere admitted that he took her to Stillwell, which is a town about 9 miles from La Porte, and saw her off on a train to Chicago. And from there, who knows where she ended up. And Lamphere claimed that Gunness was quite rich and also claimed that she had murdered 42 men by his count, possibly more. And she had accumulated an estimated $250,000 through her murder schemes over the years. And that was in that day's money. So she had made herself pretty much a millionaire by this point. We're talking $6.3 million in 2008. So this was an older research. So imagine how much money that would be today. According to, you know, financial records, she, in addition to paying off her mortgage, had indeed withdrawn most of her money shortly before the fire. So that again points to the idea that she had fled to evade the law. And then, of course, once word got around that this corpse couldn't have been Belle, the rumors began, right? And, you know, this is nationwide news. People were just shocked by all this. Not only that we have this brutal serial killer on a farm, but it's a woman. That had to have blown people's minds a little bit back then as well. It would blow our minds today, let's be honest. But over the decades, she would be allegedly sighted in cities and towns throughout the United States. There would be friends, acquaintances, and detectives spotting her in places like Chicago, San Francisco, New York, Los Angeles. As late as 1931, Gunness would be reported alive and missing in towns in the South, and one in Mississippi. Apparently, she owned a great deal of property and lived a pretty luxurious life. Sheriff Smutzer, for more than 20 years, would receive an average of 2 reports a month, and she became this part of American folklore. The bodies of Gunness's 3 children were found in the home's wreckage, but the headless female adult corpse found with them would never be positively identified. So as of now, even today, Belle Gunness's true fate and location is unknown. Residents of LaPorte were sort of divided down the middle. They either think she was killed by Ray Lamphere or that she had faked her own death. And furthering suspicions that she had faked her own death, in 1931, there was a woman known as Esther Carlson who was arrested in Los Angeles for poisoning somebody named August Lindstrom for money. 2 people who had known Gunness claimed to recognize her from photographs, but the identification was never proven, and Carlson died while awaiting trial. So that could be interesting to consider, that after all that, a repeat of her old MO ended up getting her caught and that she died in prison. That can be a comforting thought to maintain if you want to believe that she did get away with it, at least for a time. But the most recent news that I can find comes from around 2007, 2008, and that is where descendants of Belle's sister Nellie would have the headless corpse exhumed from Gunness's grave in Forest Home Cemetery in Chicago by a team of forensic anthropologists from the University of Indianapolis in an attempt to learn her true identity. You know, they initially hoped that they could get some DNA from an envelope flap on one of the letters that Belle had sent. But unfortunately, there just wasn't enough DNA there, so they were unable to do that match. So there we have it. A rather unsettling, if not unsatisfying, end to the known life and whereabouts of one of the more prolific serial killers of the 20th century. Do you think Belle Gunness died in the fire, or did she successfully make away with her fortune in the night to start a new life elsewhere? A life that perhaps ended in jail. Maybe with better DNA technology, we could eventually put this question to bed for good. Maybe we could compare familial DNA from Belle's sister to the body of the headless woman buried in Gunness's grave, assuming there's any DNA left that you could get from that body. Someone out there needs to get that done. I know Belle Gunness is no longer a threat to anyone, whether she got away or not, but some of us just need to know. Meanwhile, we still have our time machine and so much history and a bajillion bad guys and gals to see. So if that's something you're into, why not stick around for another ride? This train is firing back up, and I can't wait to see what vintage villain we find next. If you enjoyed Vintage Villains, consider leaving a review over on Apple or Spotify. Message me at vintagevillainspod@gmail.com with any questions or suggestions, or join the discussion on the Vintage Villains Facebook group or over on the Patreon page. Links to all that and more, including where you can pick up some spiffy merch to support the show, will be in the show notes. Thanks again to all of you who make this show possible. We'll see you again soon.